A 13-year-old Anderson Cooper sat in Mortimer's restaurant watching a tiny woman draped in an enormous sable coat glide past his table. He had no idea that the fur wrapped around Brooke Astor's shoulders connected directly to the bloody origins of America's first billionaire dynasty, a fortune built on animal pelts stripped from carcasses in the wilderness. The Astor name still echoes through our culture today, from subway stations to Muppet characters, representing old money and aristocratic privilege. Yet this family that once controlled 1/15th of all personal wealth in America has virtually disappeared, their billions frittered away through six generations of betrayal, extravagance, and spectacular dysfunction. What remains is a cautionary tale about the American dream's dark side, how ruthless ambition can build empires, and how those same empires crumble when the hunger that created them gives way to entitlement and decay. John Jacob Astor arrived in America as a butcher's son with nothing but ambition and an uncanny ability to spot opportunities others missed. Starting as a fur merchant in the 1780s, he didn't just participate in existing markets, he reshaped them entirely. When in 1794 treaty opened trade routes, Astor secured exclusive rights with the British East India Company, building global networks that shipped furs to China and returned with silks and tea, commanding astronomical prices in New York. His genius was shameless manipulation of every system he touched. During the War of 1812, when British blockades strangled American shipping, Astor convinced Thomas Jefferson to grant special permission for his ship to transport a Chinese worker home for a family funeral. That single voyage, conveniently loaded with furs, netted him $200,000, the first vessel permitted into New York Harbor after more than a year. The funeral was likely fiction, the profit was very real. What separated Astor from other merchants was his willingness to see regulations, treaties, and even ethics as negotiable obstacles rather than fixed boundaries. Astor didn't just want wealth, he wanted his own country. While others envisioned a unified continental United States, he imagined two nations, the eastern states ending at the Mississippi and a Pacific empire centered at the Columbia River's mouth, named Astoria. In 1810, he launched two expeditions to establish Fort Astoria. The ship Tonquin, commanded by rigid Captain Jonathan Thorne, clashed violently with independent fur traders aboard. They reached the Columbia River in March 1811, losing seven men navigating the treacherous mouth. Thorne's fate proved grimmer. After establishing the fort, he sailed north to trade at Vancouver Island, where he fatally insulted a local chief. The ensuing attack ended when a wounded crewman ignited the gunpowder magazine as indigenous raiders boarded, obliterating everyone. The Overland Party arrived starved and broken throughout 1812 after two brutal years. Their suffering was pointless. The War of 1812 erupted, British forces captured Fort Astoria, and Astor's Pacific Empire dissolved. But Astor had pivoted, pouring energy into Manhattan real estate, buying cheap land in Greenwich Village and Times Square, then leasing it long-term. Near life's end, he observed that if he could start over, he would buy every foot of land on the island of Manhattan. His fortune's foundation, possessing vision to imagine Manhattan's future when others couldn't. The Astor Opera House, opened in 1847, epitomized social division. Subscription seats cost $300 annually, nearly $10,000 today, and required evening dress, kid gloves, and clean-shaven faces. The elite enjoyed plush orchestra seating, while working-class patrons sat on uncomfortable benches in an upper cockloft. In May 1849, class tensions exploded when British actor William Charles Macready was scheduled to perform Macbeth. American actor Edwin Forrest, a working-class hero feuding with Macready, would perform the same role at a rival theater. Theatrical rivalry became symbolic warfare between American democracy and British aristocracy. On May 10th, over 10,000 protesters gathered outside. When the crowd grew violent, throwing stones through windows, the 7th Regiment militia fired, first blanks, then live ammunition. 22 people were killed and at least 30 injured. McReady fled in disguise to Europe. The Massacre Opera House became New York's deadliest riot to that point, revealing that even enormous wealth couldn't insulate the Astors from the consequences of inequality their fortune had helped create. Caroline Webster Schermerhorn Astor, the only woman who could simply be called Mrs. Astor, transformed American high society into a ruthlessly exclusive club with herself as gatekeeper. Born in 1830 to the prestigious Schermerhorn family, she married William Backhouse Astor II at 23. While William pursued racehorses, yachting, and affairs, Caroline perfected strategic ignorance, claiming seasickness prevented her from joining his yacht excursions, though her granddaughter later revealed this was fiction. With her walker, Ward McAllister, Mrs. Astor established the Society of Patriarchs and coined the term 400, representing those truly at ease in society. Their system distinguished knobs, old money, from swells, nouveau rich, requiring 3 generations' distance from money-making and at least $1 million for acceptance. Though Mrs. Astor initially resisted the Vanderbilts, Alva Vanderbilt's 1883 masquerade ball forced her capitulation. When her daughter desperately wanted to attend, Mrs. Astor had to leave her calling card at Alva's mansion, a humiliating concession, revealing even her power had limits. Mrs. Astor gave her last reception in 1905, appearing like a walking chandelier with excessive jewels. When she died in 1908, the Times noted no one would ever again hold such constitutional authority over New York's social world. On September 20, 1880, 32-year-old William Waldorf, Will Astor, began plotting his English plan, abandoning America. Born in 1848 into a strict religious household with an atmosphere of sinister religion filled with hobgoblins, Will was raised by governesses and tutors, producing a complex character, lonely and depressive, yet disciplined, with shyness and sensitivity often taking the protective forms of truculence, impulsiveness, and a thickening crust of self-reserve. Unlike his dissolute uncle, Will received a European education and dreamed of becoming a historical novelist. In 1878, he married vivacious Philadelphia belle Mary Mamie Dahlgren-Paul. Will's first mistake was encouraging Mamie to compete with his aunt Caroline for the title of Mrs. Astor. His second was political. In 1881, he ran for Congress in a Tammany Hall-controlled district containing squalid Astor-owned tenements. Will distributed cigars and spoke German in immigrant neighborhoods, but kept his gloves on when shaking hands and refused to canvass Astor tenements. He lost by just 165 votes, a public humiliation that embittered him against American journalism. President Arthur appointed him envoy to Italy, where Will and Mamie were celebrated at the royal court. After inheriting between $150 to $300 million upon his forced return to America in 1885, Will became possibly the wealthiest man in America, if not the world. Yet his aunt Caroline dismissed him as prickly while preferring her charming son Jack. By 1890, Will tore down his childhood home to build the Waldorf Hotel as an intentional affront to his aunt, then announced he was leaving America permanently, declaring it not a fit place for a gentleman to live. In England, the Astors acquired Cliven House. Will closed the previously open grounds, replacing iron gates with walls topped with broken glass, earning the nickname Waldorf Astor. His final ambition, British peerage, required approximately $5 million, $151 million today, in donations. In 1916, King George V named him Baron. He appeared in the House of Lords in his coveted robes for merely 20 minutes. Society gossips noted his honor stinks too much of sordid gold and couldn't erase the stench of bloody fur from his family's origins. In her final years, Brooke Astor, who had distributed $200 million to New York charities, was reduced to wearing threadbare nightgowns and sitting on urine-stained furniture in her neglected Park Avenue apartment. The person responsible was her own son, Anthony Tony Marshall, a man who had spent his life seeking approval from a mother who publicly belittled him even after his distinguished service at Iwo Jima. At 65, Tony fell in love with 43-year-old Charlene Gilbert, his mother's church minister's wife. Their affair scandalized their main town. Both divorced their spouses, and Charlene left her teenage children to marry Tony in 1992. Brooke never approved, publicly crushing Tony's hopes of leading her foundation. "My son is not an Astor. There is no family to leave it to." Tony worried about his wife's future. At just 22 years younger than his mother, he feared dying first and leaving Charlene with nothing. When Brooke was 98, Tony arranged for her Alzheimer's diagnosis, then made a critical mistake. He wrote a detailed 7-page letter documenting her mental decline. This letter would become crucial evidence against him. He convinced his mother to sell her beloved Child Hassam painting for $10 million, but didn't tell her when the dealer resold it for $20 million, nor about his $2 million commission. Tony redirected nearly half her estate from charities to a new Anthony Marshall Fund under his control. By 2006, his son Philip grew concerned and, after consulting former staff, met with David Rockefeller and Annette De Laurenta to file for guardianship. The case exploded as the Battle of New York Blue Bloods. On August 13, 2007, Brooke died at Holly Hill with her caregivers and Annette by her side, but not Tony or Charlene, who was banned by court order. By November 2007, Tony faced an 18-count indictment for swindling Brooke out of $14 million. After a 5-month trial, the jury found him guilty on 14 counts. He served just 8 weeks in prison before being granted medical parole. A year later, Anthony Marshall, the last Astor heir, was dead. The battle over Brooke's $185 million estate concluded in March 2012. Tony's $31 million inheritance was cut in half, and he lost control over his mother's charitable bequests. Charlene kept Cove End and received 2 mink coats that Brooke had specifically left her, size 6 coats that would never fit Charlene, a final subtle slight from her mother-in-law. The Astor name became detached from the actual family, transforming into cultural shorthand for wealth and glamour. Today, at the Astor Place subway station, ceramic beaver plaques remain as subtle reminders of John Jacob Astor's fur trading origins, modest emblems overlooked by hurried commuters, perhaps the most fitting monument to a family whose name once defined American wealth, but whose fortune has vanished into history. Their rise and fall follows a familiar pattern in American dynasties. The founder's ruthless drive creates the fortune, the second generation maintains it, the third generation enjoys it, and subsequent generations gradually dissipated through indulgence, infighting, and disconnection from the values that created it. John Jacob Astor embodied America's contradictions: the immigrant who achieved spectacular success while exploiting others, the self-made man who created dynastic wealth, the ruthless businessman who became a philanthropist only at death's door. We're living in a second Gilded Age, where the ultra-wealthy display even more ostentatious wealth than the Astors did. Yet their story serves as a cautionary tale. Fortunes built without ethical foundations eventually crumble. Social status, purchased rather than earned, rarely brings happiness, and wealth without purpose often destroys those who possess it. The Astor legacy whispers a truth we do well to remember, that even the mightiest empires built on ambition alone cannot withstand the corrosive effects of entitlement, greed, and the abandonment of the very hunger that created them. In the end, what remains isn't the billions or the ballrooms, but a simple question: what are we building, and will it outlast us?